Okay, today we will be looking at case number 48 of the Momonkan collection. So this, I've got a copy here of the book, also called The Gateless Gate. Just a little bit on koans for those that are new here today. Koans are a part of Zen practice. We call it wisdom practice. The idea is to penetrate the essence of really what Buddhism is all about, what Buddha is about, through the story that is in the koan. The koans were established in the Song Dynasty in China about 1,000 years ago. They became a Zen method, if you like, and they're unique in Buddhism in the sense that they are asking practitioners to penetrate the essence of what is in the koan. The actual koan itself consists in many ways of dialogues that were happening anywhere between the 6th century and 8th century, or even later in China. So we have these koans as a practice, a practice verification, we could even say. And we really only start looking at koans when a practitioner has had a glimpse of awakening, a glimpse of that non-dual world upstairs. Remember, I talked about being in that space between thoughts. So once we get a little bit of an inkling, or the degree to which we understand that world that we see when we have an experience like that, is the degree to which we also see what is in a koan. Okay. So there's different levels of insight that we can obtain from a koan. So it's just a little bit of an introduction on that. So I'll just get into it straight away. And first of all, let me read out the koan. So this is Kenpo's One Way, case 48. By the way, the case 48 is the last one in this collection, 48 cases. There are also verses, so roughly 100 verses. Sorry, the verses also become a koan. And so there are 100 koans just in that book alone that we use as a means to help us see that world. And this is usually also done one-on-one with a teacher. So it's not a common, we don't discuss this normally in a group. But this teisho here is about unpacking it. It's about getting exposure to it, if you like. Okay, case number 48. Kenpo's One Way. The monk asked Master Kenpo in all earnestness. In a sutra, it says, 10 direction Bhagavats, one way to the gate of Nirvana. I wonder where the way is. Kenpo lifted up his stick, drew a line and said, here it is. Later, a monk asked Udmon to give instructions about this. Udmon held up a fan and said, this fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33 devas and adheres to the nose of the deva Taishaku. When a carp in the eastern sea is struck with a stick, it rains torrents as though a tray of water is overturned. So that's the case. Now Mumon, who is a monk in China, he collected all these koans and put them into this Mumonkan collection. He wrote something. He wrote a little comment about this case. So we'll look at that comment. We look at that commentary. It's a very interesting commentary. I think it's one of Mumon's best. So here it goes. One goes to the bottom of the deepest sea, heaving sand and raising dust. The other stands on top of the highest mountain and causes white waves to billow up to the sky. On the one hand, they are gripping it tightly. On the other hand, they are letting it loose. So each of them extends a single hand, and together they support the essential principle. It is just like two running boys colliding. In this world, there will be no one who has realized the truth completely. Examining with the true eye, I find that neither of the old masters know where the way is. So that is his commentary. Then Mumon wrote a verse. The verse is, if you like, poetry, and poetry is a language that is quite often used to point to what is meant or what is seen. Okay, And it's a beautiful medium. So in the olden days, every student, if they had a realization or they looked at a koan, they were asked to put it into verse. It became a literary practice in many ways. So the verse here is also a koan, and the verse that Mumon wrote in relation to this koan goes like this. Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though you may take the initiative point by point, you must know there is still the all-surpassing whole. Now, again, those that are unfamiliar with koans, and even those that are familiar with it, they seem like, when we read them, like if you picked up a book and you just read this, you think, what are they talking about? What is this? You know. So it does require... you know, it does require some unpacking, but after a while you get used to the language. After a while we get used to really looking at it from the perspective of non-duality, and then somehow trying to see what is actually meant there. And so this is what we call wisdom practice. So this is, it's not easy for newcomers to penetrate. So let's start off with the first line, you know. A monk asked Master Kempo. Master Kempo, by the way, he was a student of Tozan. We don't really know much about it. There's no birth date there. But Tozan we know, of course, as the founder of the Soto school in Zen. And he lived between 807 and 869. So when this dialogue is supposed to have happened, it's around, you know, of the life, obviously, of Tozan. So we're talking roughly 9th century. So the monk asked Master Kempo in the sutras, okay, in the sutra. So this here is the Sugama Sutra, I think it was. In a sutra, it says, the Bhagavad in 10 directions, the one way to the gate of Nirvana. So what does Bhagavad mean, first of all? Bhagavad, and again, you need to get a little bit of, when you first read this, you need to do, you know, there's always a commentary in various books, so you need to find out what Bhagavad is, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. So a Bhagavad means a Buddha, a holy one, a deity, okay? So in this case, the Buddha. So it says very clearly, the Buddha in 10 directions. So the 10 directions is also, it also means that it means everywhere. In 10 directions, the literal meaning, according to Aitken Roshi, who was a scholar in Chinese and Japanese, the literal meaning is throughout space and time. Okay. Buddha throughout space and time. Okay. So, of course, depending on how we see Buddha, you know, Buddha obviously throughout space and time doesn't mean the historical Buddha, because the historical Buddha was clearly born 2,500 years ago, he had a lifespan, and he died. Okay, so then the question is, what is Buddha? Okay. But here it says Buddha, or all Buddhas. Remember in the session, we chant all Buddhas throughout space and time. So all Buddhas throughout space and time. That's the first thing. So it's an interesting, like the monk is asking a very interesting question. All Buddhas throughout space and time. Keep in mind what Buddha means. Buddha means awakening. The awakened one, but also coming from the word Bodhi, you know, Buddha Bodhi, awakened one. Okay, so awakening throughout space and time is another way of translating. The modern way of looking at it is awakening throughout space and time, or enlightenment throughout space and time. Okay, the one way to the gate of Nirvana. Okay, so that is asking the one way. To the gate of Nirvana, the one way to the gate of Nirvana. So Buddha in all directions, the one way to the gate of Nirvana. This is what it says in a sutra. Okay. So again, important here, the first thing as a Zen, as someone looking at that koan is to really look at that phrase. You know, the Buddha in 10 directions. What is Buddha? We all know, we are already complete. We sit, we always say, sit like a Buddha. So a Buddha could be Maggie, or it could be Pat, or it could be James. James in all directions, you know. Maggie in all directions, you know. Keep in mind, koans are about you, about us, okay? Not individually, but who we truly are beyond the separatedness that we create all the time. That's what it's always about, okay? So Buddha or Maggie or Bodhi or James throughout space and time, what is that? You know, in all directions, okay? The one way to the gate of Nirvana. You know, so how do you look at the one way? You know, like, what is the way? Is it the Zen way? Is it the Theravadan way? Is it the Buddhist way? Is it a Christian way? Is it the Muslim way? Is that really what is meant? What way is it? The one way? Or is it the oneness way? One way as in there's only one. There is no two. The one way, okay, to the gate of Nirvana. In other words, nothing else. Undividable, you know. Buddha in all directions, the one way. Of course, that is the way we need to see it. Okay? The one way to Nirvana is not there is only one way or there is this way. It is oneness. That is Nirvana. Seeing the world of absolute oneness, that is Nirvana. The one way to Nirvana, you know. So that takes away self, that takes away Ano, that takes away, but of course it includes it all as well. You know, the oneness way to Nirvana. Okay. So that is a very powerful sentence to start off the koan with. Okay. But of course when we first read that sentence, we divvy it up into all sorts of concepts, you know, and then we get confused. We think, what's this, the one way to Nirvana, which way? The Bhagavats, whatever it is, the Bhagavats in 10 directions. Oh, what direction is that? You know, throughout space and time, in all the universe, you know, all the universe, nothing other than Gary, nothing other than James, nothing other than Stick. There is no separation whatsoever. The oneness way, the oneness way. No division, you know, to Nirvana. Excuse me, to Nirvana. Okay. Obviously, there are various koans that point to this. When the Buddha is said to have had his enlightenment experience from a Zen tradition, according to Zen, according to another Zen koan, he is supposed to have said, "I alone am the honored one." I alone is the same as one. Not I alone, I me. As in, there is nothing other than I, no separation. So everything falls into I, you know, if you like. Everything falls into Stick. Everything falls into Maggie. Everything falls into Pat. There is no separation, you know. I alone, he saw it. There is actually nothing other than me, you know. Everything I see is nothing other than me myself. No separation, including God. You know, no separation whatsoever. That is, you know, there are a few koans that point to this. Simultaneously seeing every, you know, time and space, simultaneously seeing it as one. Okay. The one way to the gate of Nirvana, the oneness way to the gate, the oneness way. Please get that, the oneness way. You know, that really seeing it, like, there it is, Nirvana, the oneness way to Nirvana. Where we go. Okay. So, Nirvana, of course, you know, what is Nirvana? Nirvana is exactly that, what I've just described. This oneness way, that is Nirvana. Of course, we differentiate Nirvana between samsara. So, the opposite of Nirvana is samsara in Buddhism. Samsara means... it means the cycle of life. Okay. You could say Nirvana is non-duality, samsara is duality. You could say it that way if you like. The classical definition of Nirvana is unboundedness. You know, in other words, even a fire is still bound. The example that is made in early Buddhist teachings is that even a fire is still bounded by the fuel, okay, so that it consumes. So unboundedness is this total freedom, this total liberation. Nothing binds us anymore. Okay, that's another way of looking at nirvana. Yamada Roshi in the Teisho, he says, nirvana is surpassing life and death. Yeah, another interesting way of looking at it. So what surpassing life and death is like if I eat an orange, and I say, presuming that orange is an orange, as in it's right there, it's, you could say it's alive, there are cells in there, there's all sorts of things that are happening in an orange, and now I eat it. Is it dead? Is it alive? Was it alive? Now I eat it. Where is it gone? I've eaten it. Okay. So it's like surpassing life and death is, was there an orange in the first place? One minute, if there was an orange, where is it gone? Where is the orange? So meaning that all these things that we see as impermanent, we think that they're there. But actually, everything is a transformation of something else. This book, there's a forest had to grow. Oxygen had to be there. The Big Bang had to happen for this book to exist. You know, does this book exist? Does it not exist? Surpassing life and death points to all of that. If we think something dies, it's like, well, what do you mean dies? You know, what do you mean being alive? So anyway, that was his definition. So coming back to this sentence, the monk asked Master Kempo, in the sutra it says, the Bhagavad in 10 directions, the one way to the gate of nirvana. I wonder where the way is. Okay. So he didn't know. It was a genuine question. I wonder where the way is. He hasn't seen the oneness way. He just read that sentence. Okay. So what did Kempo do? Kempo held up his staff, drew a line in the air, and he said, here it is. There it is. That was his. Okay. And of course, we need to see. We need to see what this means. Or we need to see what he's referring to with this action. Okay, later it goes on in the koan. A monk asks, we don't know whether it's the same monk or another monk, presumably, because there's a monk, not the monk. Later a monk asked Unmon to give instructions about this, saying, okay, talk to me about this. Unmon held up his fan. Okay. So Unmon held up his fan. Okay. And said, this fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33 divas, and adheres to the nose of the diva Taishaku, which is Indra, by the way. When a carp in the eastern sea is struck with a stick, it rains torrents as though a tray of water is overturned. So he held up a fan and he says, this fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33 divas. I want to talk, if I can, a little bit about heaven, especially in a Buddhist context. It's got actually nothing to do with this koan, but we don't often talk about these things, and it's good for people to maybe get a little bit of an understanding of what is meant by heaven. This goes into Buddhist cosmology. Okay. So in Buddhist cosmology, there are different realms. Okay, there are different realms that we, as people can migrate to, into. Now, there's two ways to look at those. You can interpret them literally, as in really believing that they exist, as realms, you know. And that is, of course, the ancient Buddhists believed that, similar to, say, the realm of heaven that, say, Christians might believe in, and the realm of hell that Christians believe in, and the realm of purgatory. So there are three realms there, for instance. And other religions also have realms. So Buddhism has, they have these six realms. So that's one way is to look at them literally, and a lot of Buddhists believe that they exist. And the whole idea of karma and rebirth is linked with those realms. So the idea is that if we, you know, depending on our karma, depending on our moral conduct, we will be reborn, you know, into one of those realms, okay, after we have experienced the realm of being human. So that is, again, this is the way the traditional Buddhist interpret this. So with karma and rebirth, it works like this. If my karma is unwholesome, and I do a lot of bad things, I will go into the hell realm. And if I do a lot of good things, I'll get into the heaven realm or the God realm, God realm. Okay, so a lot of we might all be familiar through stories with this concept, through various stories and also various religious traditions that we may belong to. And Buddhism, as I said, has the same thing. The other way to look at this is the realms can be interpreted as states of mind. In other words, we can go up and down those realms depending on where our state of mind is at any given moment. Okay. So that is a more contemporary way of looking at it. Some Buddhists would be horrified at that type of way of looking at it, and then some others, it starts making sense for some others. So I'll leave it up to you, which one you believe is. Speaking for myself, I don't know whether these realms exist or not exist. It's improbable to me that these realms exist. So I find it always very difficult when I look at Buddhist cosmology. They lived in a different era and they looked at it differently than the way we do. But let's just look at them from those two perspectives. So the first one is hell. So there are lower realms and then there are higher realms. Okay. So the hell realm is a realm that is basically seen through suffering. So where there is a lot of suffering, you make sense. If there's a lot of suffering, that is hell. You know. So we can see that even with people that are suffering even today, a state of mind full of anxiety, full of suffering, at that moment we can say we're experiencing hell. You know. A good example might be prison, where we also teach mindfulness. You could say that prison is a form of hell. It might not necessarily be the location and the physical aspect of a prison, but the prison of the mind. The prison of the mind whereby we feel so imprisoned, we have maybe had really bad upbringings, we are completely confused, we are living in this world of constant struggle. That is hell, you know. That is hell on earth. Yeah. So that's one realm, and of course karma plays a huge part of that. Then there's the hungry ghost realm. So the hungry ghost realm, as I talked about before in session, is that describes beings that are never satisfied. You know, beings that are never satisfied. The desire kicks in, and it's greed. It's the greedy realm. And, you know, like that famous saying, the happiest person or the most satisfied person is the person that is satisfied with what they got. You know, that sort of gets you out of that, satisfied with what they got. But we can see, even in us, an element that is never satisfied. That is the hungry ghost. These are shadows. These are shadows that are called shadows in psychology that we can inhabit at any given moment. We can fall into that realm, never being satisfied. We all know, probably, we can point to people in our lives that we see, or that we maybe see even in movies, or we see on the news, you know, where people are in that realm. Never satisfied, always looking for more, 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 more. You know, that's different ways of looking at it. The animal realm. The animal realm is the realm that is very basic. You know, basically, it's food and shelter and procreation. You know, here, you know, the parallel when I thought about this is when I look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, once we've seen, so it's very much needs based. There are people on this earth that, you know, they are born into such a situation that all they worry about is their next meal. All they worry about is shelter, you know, and then there's maybe a sexual drive and there's procreation happening. But that is the existence. Before you get to any other realm, that needs to be satisfied. We need to have shelter, we need to have food. Only then can we start getting into a higher realm of looking at other things. Like meditation is a very, very luxurious practice. We need to already have surpassed the realm of shelter and hunger. In our society, in Australia, Western world, we have done that. You know. But there are countries and there are people that have not experienced that. So that is the animal realm, if you like. And at any moment, keep in mind, we can go into those realms. You only need someone like Putin to come in and look what he does in the Ukraine. All of a sudden, those people, basic existence is what now takes over every other priority. You know. Then there's the human realm. And in Buddhism, the human realm, funnily enough, is the hardest one to get into. And according to Buddhist mythology, the human realm is the one, it's the only realm where we can get awakened. Okay, that's the only realm where we can get awakened. And it's the only way, the only realm where a Buddha can appear, and it's the only realm where we can actually practice. You know, so according to Buddhism, being a human being is already it's already a higher realm. Okay, it's a very special realm, if you like, and it's the only realm where we can realize nirvana. All other realms we can't. Okay, so that is in the human realm. You can say another way, okay, I'll keep going. There's two more. One is the demigod and the other one is the god. So demigod realm and the god realm, they are in heaven. Okay. But the demigod one is categorized as godlike but fighting for power. Okay. So they're in a godlike realm. In other words, they got it good, but they're preoccupied still with power. And again, we can probably picture some people that we see on television that they've got everything, but they're power hungry. You know, maybe Putin falls into this, you know, that they cannot, they've got the world as their oyster, you know, but they cannot, they're consumed by power. Okay, so that's the demigod realm. And then there's the god realm. Okay, and the god realm is where you enjoy a life of pleasure, no worry, no anxiety, no financial stress. You know, everything is there, and there are people living like that as well, except they're attached. So that's the one negative part about the God realms, again, according to Buddhist mythology, that people that live there are attached, and therefore it doesn't last. Okay. So the Buddha is said, he's in the different sutras, he is said to have been able to move from realm to realm and teaching in all realms. So he was a teacher of the gods, he was a teacher of the semi-gods, and a teacher to the humans, and that's what a Buddha can do. He can go from one realm to the other at will. Okay. So again, you can look at the realms as in, do they really exist as realms out there, separate from Earth, or do they exist as states of mind? So I'll leave that up to you to ponder. And just a little bit on that as well, when I looked at this, you know, the human realm, you can almost, another way of looking at it maybe is, you know, like a demigod and god realm, all these other realms are dysfunctional. And the human realm, to some degree, hopefully, is functional. So if we can get into a functional state or wholesome state, that's another way of maybe looking at it. So this is all quite interesting. And of course, rebirth plays, you know, rebirth, as in we can be reborn in any realm at any given stage. At any given stage, we can be reborn. We can fall into those states of mind. That's another way of looking at it. As I said, traditional Buddhists would be horrified at this, but it's just something that that I wanted to bring out, as maybe it makes some sense. Or not. So, okay. So, Unmon held up the fan. Coming back to the koan. Unmon held up the fan. Okay. And he said, this fan jumps to the heaven of the 33 devas. So, this fan jumps to the heaven. In other words, it's all of our activity, including, according to what they believed in those days, activity that happens beyond Earth. In other words, in all direction, this fan jumps right through all those realms, okay, right up to the highest point. You know. So again, what is this? This fan jumps right up there. You know, and look at the oneness aspect. You know, oneness, as in what is this? What is this stick? What is this? You know, nirvana, oneness. You know, once we see the oneness, all those realms, you know, up being that's all part of it. You know, there is nothing that is separate. You know, so another way of looking at that is our activity. You know, I make that point quite often. What is activity? What's the difference between sitting on a cushion and walking down the street or driving a car? Everything is one activity. The only difference is our state of mind. What, even driving a car, it's just a label. We only have so many movements in our body that we can make, sitting, standing, running, stretching, bending, lifting, whatever, that and we call them yoga, meditation, office work. We call them driving. We call them all these things that we call them sick, healthy, operating, digging. You know, we have all this activity that we categorize. One activity, you know, oneness. There's oneness. Seeing just with one activity, divide up into all these different concepts that we use to differentiate them with. Okay. This fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33 divas. So that activity, it jumps up to the... It is nothing other than that activity and adheres to the nose. Even the nose of Indra it adheres to. Okay. That's what he is saying. The fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33 divas and adheres to the nose of the diva, Indra. Okay. When a carp in the east, and then it goes on, when a carp in the eastern sea is struck with a stick, it rains torrents as though a tray of water is overturned. Again, it's a sentence that, you know, makes sense once you've seen that world of oneness, you know. But of course, when we start differentiating it between carp and water and stick and rain and overturned, then we just see it that way. We just see it as separation. But seeing that carp, you know, stick, rain, one existence, all of a sudden it makes sense. That everything is everything else. There is no separation. Everything is everything else. No separation. Then it starts making sense of what he meant by this. Okay. Not an easy thing to see. Okay, so here's the koan. Now we go on to Mumon's commentary. One goes to the bottom of the deepest sea, heaving sand and raising dust. The other stands on top of the highest mountain, causing white waves to billow up to the sky. Gripping it tightly or letting it loose, each of them extends a single hand, and together they support the essential principle of the school. It is like two running boys colliding. In the world, there will be no one who can or has realized the truth completely. Examining with the true eye, you will find that neither of the old master know where the way is. Okay, one goes to the bottom of the deepest sea. So this refers to Kenpo, lifting up a stick. So the deepest sea. One goes to the deepest sea. In other words, he is showing us that world of emptiness, that world that we see when we have that glimpse of non-duality. One goes to the deepest sea. Just Gute's finger, right here. That's the deepest sea. That is like really seeing that. Is what our Zen practice is all about. Heaving sand and raising dust. So at the same time, it goes to the, there's no dust and sand in the sea. So he's stirring it up. So how does he stir it up? So again, not easy to see. He's stirring up by saying, here it is. You know, he shows it and then he says, there it is. Okay. There's no there in that world. You know, so he's showing those both worlds beautifully. He's saying, you know, he's been asked that question, where is it? Where is Nirvana? Bang, he lifts up the stick. You know, the deepest sea, that is the deepest sea. And then he goes and spoils it by saying, there it is. You know, there it is. You know. But those two worlds of talking about it and showing it are beautifully come together. You know, so that's what he's saying. One goes to the bottom of the deepest sea, heaving sand and raising dust. So by saying here it is, he's raising dust. Why? Because if we say there it is, there really, there, is there such a thing as there in this world of oneness? There is no there. So he's trying to explain it. You know, he's trying to say there it is, but you can't by explaining it. You can't, because we fall into that world of talking and dialogue and. Even though that is it itself already as well, but we are raising dust, we are creating confusion. He's creating confusion simply by falling back into time, saying, there it is. You know. So those two things, look at them clearly. The other, now referring to Unmon, he's saying, stands on top of the highest mountain, raises the fan, standing on top of the highest mountain, that is raising the fan. The highest mountain. Okay. causing white waves to billow up to the sky. And then he spoils it by saying the carp and da-da-da and torrents, and the carp goes up to heaven and there's divas and there's, it touches the nose of the diva Indra. Totally spoils it by saying that. So he's trying to explain it again with a metaphor maybe, you know. But that is also what we do. So there's these two aspects always. There is that emptiness aspect, but that emptiness aspect, if it is articulated, which of course we do, we articulate it, then it is also creates dust and it creates confusion because we are stuck in that duality. We can't see it. Okay. Of course, someone with a clear eye should be able to see it. So gripping it tightly, he says next, in other words, he's holding on to the essence of what this is all about. Gripping it tightly or letting it loose. In other words, letting it loose, letting it fall into where we can all of a sudden don't see it as clearly anymore because words conflict with it. Okay. Gripping it tightly on one hand and letting it loose, you know. Each of them extends a single hand, meaning each, Kenpo and Unmon, they're actually showing oneness in both instances. A single hand, two ways of looking at it. One aspect is the essential aspect, the non-dual aspect, and the other one is showing the dual aspect. So it's showing us both, you know, extending a single hand. Each of them, Kempo and Unmon, extends a single hand, and together they support the essential principle of the school. One cannot be without the other. We cannot live in the world of emptiness, and if we live in the world of manyness, both of which is difficult. Just in living in a world of emptiness, we can't communicate, we can't, you know, we're useless. Living in a world of manyness without seeing the world of oneness is where all the confusion comes in, and we don't see it either. So he's showing a single hand, you know, and it's beautifully put, a single hand. Together they support the essential principle of the school. One hand, two perspectives, dual, non-dual. Then he goes on. It is like two running boys colliding. I had to look this up. This was really confusing me. It's like two running boys colliding. And there was one commentary I read, it started making sense. It's like when two boys collide, they meet. They meet together, you know. So the essential or the dual and the non-dual meet together, you know. And they cover the whole distance as well. They meet like two running boys colliding, you know. In this world, there will be no one who has realized the truth completely. That is, again, very powerful. What is he saying? In this world, there will be no one who has realized the truth completely. Why? As soon as you find someone that has realized the truth, then the alarm bell should go up. That we can only realize oneness. There's no separation. There's only oneness. See, if you say, I am enlightened, or I have realized the truth, or this person has realized the truth, then they're stuck. They're stuck in me and them. There's only one. We can only enlighten together. It only works together. And for that to work, we need to drop the self. We need to let go of self. Then when self has disappeared, then that world emerges. That's all that we need to do is drop the self, and that when I say that's all we need to do, yeah, it's not that easy, of course. But when that world emerges, that world is all out there for everyone to see. Our job is to, again, drop the self. That's what we practice. So in this world, there will be no one who has realized the truth completely. There is no one that is separate from someone else, you know. There is no one that is separate from someone else. So how can someone, you know, become enlightened or realize the truth? Examining with the true eye, you will find that neither of the old masters know where the way is. Of course, neither of the old masters know where the way is. You know, no one knows where the way is. You know, it's just the way. You know, there's no one there. That's again, very powerful statement by Unmon. So keep that in mind, and keep that in mind when working on koans. That is what, you know, people often refer to I in koans, and while that's happening, we don't see it. We need to really be alert to that. Then he writes another beautiful verse. Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. So, before a step is taken, the goal is reached. You know. So we think we need to take a step in order to become awakened, or in order to get a Kensho experience, or in order to get liberation. It's already here. Before, it's already there. How can you go there? It's already there. There's impossible to go anywhere. You know, it's right here. Before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. And of course, when we see it like that. All we do is count, or all we do is repeat mu. It's right there. Before a step is taken, the goal is already reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Same thing. Though you may take the initiative point by point, in other words, though you may follow the method point by point, though you may take the initiative of really practicing hard point by point, you must know that there's still the all-surpassing whole. The all-surpassing whole. You must know there is still the all-surpassing whole.